You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Last year, a Marine Corps recruiter in San Francisco went looking for a few good men, but he made a mistake in recruiting Stephen Funk, a soft-spoken teenager who reads Noam Chomsky and has a lengthy history as a peace activist. Funk joined, but when he was called up for duty in March, he chose not to show up, deciding instead to stay at home and process his application to become a conscientious objector. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with Funk recently about his case and his reasons for becoming a conscientious objector.
I went through boot camp, and I went through two other forms of training. And by the time I got into the third phase of training, I decided that I wanted out of the military. I was never counseled on what conscientious objection was, but I became a conscientious objector in boot camp. I raised my problems with shouting out kill daily to chaplains, and I talked about my personal conflictions with being in the military and holding these beliefs. But it wasn't until I did research on my own that I actually found out that there was a legal way for people in the military who are opposed to war to have a way out.
Were you ever really sort of interested in fighting in a war? Did you ever give that much thought, or did you have much of a political activist background growing up?
Well, I did have a political activist background. I was born in Seattle. I protested the WTO, and I protested the DNC when I moved to LA. And I went to a very politically active high school. When I decided to join, it didn't come from having much thought at all on war. And that sounds really irresponsible, but if you ask a lot of people that join, they'll tell you the same thing, that they join for other reasons, you know, to get the reasons like I joined, like to get direction in their life, to get a sense of belonging, to get some organization. And most people that join aren't the hardcore people that are depicted in some of the movies, you know. Most people that join are just looking for those other things. They're looking for resources that they aren't getting in their life, and they're looking for discipline and things like that.
So how exactly did you end up joining the Marine Reserves? Did you join on your own, or were you approached by a recruiter?
Well, I made the decision to join. You know, I wasn't coerced much, but a recruiter found my number somehow and began calling my home, and eventually I gave in and said, okay, I'll go. He invited me to a pulley function, which is all the people that are waiting to get into boot camp, and it was an obstacle course, and all the other people had already sworn in and were all waiting for their scheduled boot camp, and I was attracted by the teamwork and the athleticism and, like I said, a sense of belonging that I felt was lacking in my life.
When you held this press conference outside the San Jose, California Marine Reserve Base back in April to declare that you were a pacifist and to file for conscientious objector status, and then you turned yourself in, you also announced that you're gay. If you don't mind me asking, how does that factor into this whole situation?
The important thing for me was that my pacifist viewpoint got out. The fact that I'm gay is just secondary, and the only reason I announced it is because it's true. And I'm not closeted, and perhaps I was sick of being closeted from being in the military, but it's just another factor in who I am.
You never considered simply trying to get out of the Marines by telling your superiors that about your sexual orientation? I assume that would have made your task a lot easier.
It would have, you know. In fact, I would have been out in 3 weeks, but I didn't tell them I was gay because I thought that would be really intellectually dishonest. That's not my problem with the military. I reject being in the military because I believe that war is immoral. And that's what I want to be discharged for. And I realized it was a lot harder to do that. And, you know, if all I wanted was to get out, then I could have just done that. But I wanted to make, you know, understand this is a personal choice, and it wouldn't be right if I just got out because of that, because I can deal with being hated for being gay, but I can't deal with being forced to cause that pain in, you know, for other people.
Mm. What was the initial response of the military when you held your press conference and announced your stance?
Well, I told the military in advance that I was doing a press conference. I had no idea that it would balloon so big. But the captain, my commanding officer, Captain O'Rourke, came out and, you know, he acknowledged that I was a conscious objector and that this is something that there are people in the military that are opposed to military action, and that he tried to downplay it, saying that it's not significant, this happens all the time. But he also said that I'd be treated fairly, and he assured the press that I would, you know, be dealt with in a fair manner and not be persecuted for any other reason, you know, for being gay, for going public, for all these things. He said it would be an expedient and fair process for me. I've been waiting here doing nothing in New Orleans for 4 months, waiting to be court-martialed. I'm not being treated fairly. I'm the only conscious objector who is being court-martialed, and one of the only deserters that's being court-martialed out of a long list of deserters. And I wasn't really a deserter in the classical sense. I was gone 47 days. I told them I was going to be gone. I told them why, because I wanted to finish my application and I wanted to be a good application for being a conscious objector. And I think the reason why there's been a lot of public response is because people see it as that I'm just being punished because I spoke out, and the military doesn't like that. Especially the Marines don't like that. They tend to be more hardcore types, more keeping to themselves and not wanting publicity.
So you think you've been singled out for your anti-war activism?
Yes.
Mm. Do you think the threat of prosecution has grown stronger against you now that some time has passed and your case has faded for the most part from the media spotlight?
Well, I think that was the point in Captain O'Rourke saying that I would be treated fairly, was so that the media would go away, so the media would think that, they're going to treat him fairly, this isn't interesting anymore. And, of course, that's not true. But I have a really good case against the charges that were brought against me, because even if I'm being tried by military people, I think that they'll follow the rules. Military people have their obligations to the military, but they also, these people, I think, will be somewhat fair.
What exactly is your current status, and what penalties do you possibly face?
Well, I was charged with shirking important duty. The maximum punishment for that is a year in prison, a bad conduct discharge, and a loss of pay.
Where are you right now? You said you're in New Orleans. What is the location you're at, and where exactly are you stationed?
Stationed at a naval support base.
Why were you sent there?
All the conscious objectors were sent here. Most of the conscious objectors sent here are gone. They've already been processed out. I think 90% of them were approved, and the rest of them will get discharged some way or another. So they want to try and make my case look like conscious objection isn't a good thing to do, because, you know, if they come down on me hard, then it might deter people from following their conscience. But if you look at all the people that applied for it, most of them got approved. I did this to encourage people that feel like I do to apply for it and not to be hypocritical and not to put it off, because that's what I did. I should have applied for it earlier.
Did you have a chance to interact much with the other, 22 other people there who had applied as conscientious objectors?
Yes, it was nice. At first, it was kind of uncomfortable because I was the only one that went public, and because I'm gay, and people object for religious reasons or moral reasons, and some of their teachings teach them to not think being gay is okay. So at first that was kind of uncomfortable. But, you know, I'm a nice guy, and eventually we got along. It was really cool because the conscientious objectors, you know, we all read similar books, and it was sort of like a philosophy club. We were kept, a lot of us were kept in the same unit, and it was nice having something in common, finally, with people in the Marine Corps.
What do you think will happen with your case?
Well, you know, at this point, I'm sort of just wanting it to be over. It's next week. You know, part of the disadvantage of me winning is I would still be in the military. I wouldn't be discharged. I don't expect that if I do lose that I would get a harsh sentence. Or if I did, I have the option to appeal it. I think if I am prosecuted, then it might say to people thinking about joining, hey, look what they do to people in the military. They don't let them have freedom of speech. They don't let them be themselves. You know, people might have to think about it if they read my story. I don't think that the military's goal of trying to persuade people from not being conscious objectors will work.
Stephen Funk is a 21-year-old Marine Corps reservist and a conscientious objector. He says he was influenced by his part Native American upbringing and his grandfather, who he calls the ultimate pacifist. You can make a donation to support his legal fund and receive updates on his military tribunal scheduled for September 4th by going to www.notinourname.net.
A young Lakota asked his grandfather why life had to be so difficult sometimes. This was the old man's reply. Grandfather says this: in life, there is sadness as well as joy, losing as well as winning, falling as well as standing, hunger as well as plenty, bad as well as good. Grandfather does not say this to make you despair, but to teach you reality, to teach you that life is a journey sometimes walked in light, sometimes in shadow. Grandfather says this: you did not ask to be born, but you are here. You have weaknesses as well as strengths. You have both because in life there are two of everything. Within you is the will to win as well as the willingness to lose. The heart to feel compassion as well as the smallness to be arrogant. Within you is the way to face life as well as the fear to turn away from it. Grandfather says this: life can give you strength. It can come from facing the storms of life, from knowing loss, feeling sadness and heartache, from falling into the depths of grief. You must stand up in the storm. You must face the wind and the cold and the darkness. When the storm blows hard, you must stand firm, for it is not trying to knock you down. It is really trying to teach you to be strong. Grandfather says this: being strong means taking one more step toward the top of the hill, no matter how weary you may be. It means letting the tears flow through the grief. It means to keep looking for the answer, though the darkness of despair is all around you. It means to cling to hope for one more heartbeat, for one more sunrise. Each step, no matter how difficult, is one more step closer to the top of the hill. To keep hope alive for one more heartbeat at a time leads to the light of the next sunrise and the promise of a new day.
Legend of the Warrior, Keep Going by Joseph Firecrow with Joseph Marshall. While the Bush administration prepares for talks with North Korea, it announced last week that it is also stepping up military pressure with plans for a joint naval exercise next month. Administration officials said the intention is to send a sharp signal to North Korea to dismantle its nuclear weapons program. But just what is this all about? Some analysts and critics familiar with the situation say that much of the discussion currently taking place about Korea, both within the media and in the Bush administration, fails to take into account the history and context of U.S.-Korea relations. We turn now to Professor Han S. Park, the director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia, who provides a framework for understanding the current political situation.
Many people are puzzled by the fact that a country as poor, as desperate, as isolated internationally, and still has such military preparedness. I believe North Korea has nuclear bombs and has a full ability to produce without importing any parts or relying on foreign technology. So you have to, in history, you have to think about Japanese occupation period, which ran from 1910 to 1945. Kim Il-sung was a national leader, and he was a guerrilla warfare leader in China, Manchuria, during that period when he was quite young. I read his autobiography. Repeatedly, he shows his amazement at the might of nuclear bomb that made Japan, the Japanese Empire, surrender instantly. So he developed intense desire to develop that very weapon so that no one can interfere with North Korea. So that intense desire was carried on to his policy when he assumed the power in 1948. For, you know, he died in 1974, so it's a long time span. Consistently and persistently, he pursued a nuclear program. So they did develop the indigenous capability. So it's very difficult to curtail North Korean nuclear program with external pressure. And I think you have to put yourselves in North Korean shoes. They are really up against the wall. We're talking about an ordinary, North Korea is an ordinary system in many respects, a system that is against the wall and that has lost all allies. The Soviet Union disappeared, China changed, Eastern European allies all gone. And whereas in South Korea, the security alliance, the United States, Japan, and South Korean alliance intact, even strengthened with ever-sophisticated weapons presence in South Korea, coupled with periodic joint military exercises. So they have developed intense fear, and they develop a sort of mentality or mindset that might be called a siege mentality. In fact, if you look objectively, their fear is very justified. Right now, Iraq is gone, destroyed. I mean, the United States destroyed Iraq, and Iran and North Korea may be next targets. So North Korea is very mindful of that. North Korea had a reason to be fearful of the United States military policy. So given that, in order to survive, you know, in the part of the regime, they're not going to give up a weapons program. What might be enough incentive for North Koreans to consider reducing or even doing away with the weapons program? It's going to be very difficult. I personally think that economic sanction, blockade, all these sanctions short of the military are not going to work, because they have been sanctioned to the bone for the last 5-10 years. If a country will collapse because of economic difficulties, North Korea would have collapsed many times over. A country doesn't collapse because of economic difficulty. In fact, we don't have a whole lot of pressure instruments. That is, with what can we pressure anymore? They're not trading with other governments. They're not importing any spare parts. What can we do? And of course, the Bush administration is contemplating on attacking using surgical military strikes. That is never going to work, because North Korea is no Iraq. It has a very formidable military preparedness. And North Korea military buildup was made or has been made at the expense of enormous amount of sacrifices in the area of economic development, the human sufferings, and so on. In other words, their weapons are much more precious, or at least regarded precious, than we think weapons in other countries. So they're not going to see, in my opinion, sit down and just witness the dismantling of their weapons by surgical strikes from the United States. They will have every incentive and motivation to use those weapons before too late. So that leaves only one option. You have to resolve this issue peacefully.
Now, what would be the steps towards peaceful resolution?
What North Korea wants is very clear. They want security assurance. And very specifically, they want to conclude the Korean War. There's no reason to prolong this armistice agreement or truce, temporary ceasefire situation beyond 50 years. And then they want more regional security regime or peace regime. However, the United States wants North Korea to give up weapons of mass destruction unconditionally. Now, actually, we're looking beyond, looking at North Korea from American point of view, beyond the border, the enemy, and telling them, you give up your weapons program. While we have all kinds of arsenals of weapons, they're not going to be persuaded by that. And if they say, yes, we'll give up, but to believe that they're telling the truth is utterly naive. So you've got to alleviate this armistice agreement situation, replace it with some sort of peace arrangement first. I guess eventually, I think both sides should compromise, especially the United States. What is likely to happen is a multilateral situation. And a collapsed North Korea will be a nightmare. Literally millions of people will come out into China. That's not only economic burden, but more importantly, it's a diplomatic nightmare. And the South Korean economy and society are not going to be prepared for the absorption of North Koreans.
How do you see the current talk in the U.S. about pulling back troops away from the border between North and South? Do you see that as a destabilizing move?
And I think that move, the real intent, I don't know. Any speculation may be plausible. But the perception is that the Bush administration, especially the Defense Department, Rumsfeld and his people, may be thinking military strike seriously, maybe removing potential targets in the form of American military personnel away from the harm's way. And that very thought, perception, is very dangerous because North Koreans, I'm certain, that are led to believe that. This is a part of their preparation to attack us. You know, North Korea is no Iraq or Afghanistan. The United States, months ago, they assembled more than 200,000 soldiers there in Middle East, you know, surrounding Iraq. And then all kinds of bluffings and so forth, you know. If you did that, the North Korea will preemptive strike. Because if they are destroyed, they lose most of the capability to counterattack. So in this case, the troop movements from the front line back and perhaps some partial removal of ground troops from South Korea, that would be interpreted by North Koreans as a part of war preparation. And I think it's very dangerous. That can trigger North Korean action anytime.
What would be, if you could deliver a message to citizens in the U.S., what would be your recommendation for what they should convey to their leaders in Congress?
The tragic fact is that North Korea is not known to the American public. And what they know is largely distorted and wrong. I've been an American citizen for 40 years. I know America fairly well. And I know North Korea and South Korea very well. The American public has the right to know world affairs, in this case, North Korea. And I think it's basically journalists and reporters, people who are involved in opinions making in the United States, it's their obligation to try to go into North Korea, bring them out, and read the material, and directly, indirectly, try to ascertain as closely factual information as possible, and tell the American people, this is North Korea. North Korean Kim Jong-il, I don't have love affair with him, but he's no Saddam Hussein. He hasn't mass murdered his own people. He's respected by his people. And in North Korea, there is no power conflict. There has never been. After Kim Jong-il, there will be no potential individual or groups to succeed him. So the American government needs to have whole new policy toward North Korea. The same jacket cannot fit there. So the formula that seemingly militarily successful toward Iraq and Afghanistan. Hey, who would be surprised by the fact that the United States military militarily physically destroyed Iraq and Afghanistan? It's not a big deal. The battle was won by the United States, but the war is still being waged as we speak. So I like to see American policymakers and, more importantly, American public to have a much bigger perspective. And I really hope this axis of evil and dismantling and regime change, this syndrome will be short-lived. This is just a passing, like a summer rain. You know, I don't think this can be prolonged in international domain, and I hope, certainly hope not.
Professor Han S. Park is the director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia. He spoke with Mike McCormick as part of the radio series Mind Over Matters. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. Thank you.